The following program is intended for an audience that is blind or print impaired. I'm Kurt Benrud. Welcome to Science Fiction Shorts, brought to you by a team of volunteer readers. Our program will be available in podcast after the initial broadcast.
Hi, this is Jackie Robel, and this story is called The Identical Infants by A.C. Spahn.
Thanks for coming so quickly, Professor, said Detective Faraday. This case is a little urgent.
I've told you not to bother with titles. Professor Kara Watt, paranormal investigator, turned in a slow circle, taking in the lavish nursery, plush carpet on the floor, hand-painted cartoon characters on the wall, twin newborns in matching pajamas in the mahogany crib. A teary-eyed woman in business attire hovered, figuratively, over the babies. A smaller woman in a silk gown hovered, literally, beside a uniformed police officer in the corner. Her translucent wings kept her aloft, though her wrist was handcuffed to the officer guarding her.
"I see you have a fairy in custody," Kara said.
Detective Faraday wiped his brow with his sleeve.
Yes, we do.
Kara eyed him.
Still not comfortable with our townsfolk?
Last week, I found out the mailman is a dragon. An actual dragon.
That's Rax. He delivers to my neighborhood, too. Always very prompt.
She grinned at the detective.
It's the wings. You didn't notice his lack of a mail truck?
Faraday tucked his hands in his pockets.
Let's just focus on why we're here.
It's the baby, said the woman in business clothes. She sniffled. She's only 2 weeks old.
Kara arched an eyebrow.
You look good for someone who had twins 2 weeks ago.
The woman began to sob. Faraday spoke quietly.
Mrs. Gonzalez didn't have twins. She came in to check on her daughter's nap and found this fairy holding the baby. She screamed, and the fairy set the baby in the crib. Only then Mrs. Gonzalez realized there were two babies. One is her real daughter.
Kara inhaled sharply. The other, a fey changeling. Faraday nodded.
The fairy was in the process of swapping the fairy child for the real one, but we don't know how far she'd gotten. Was the baby she set down the real baby, or the imposter?
May I?
Kara placed a gentle hand on Mrs. Gonzalez's shoulder. The sobbing woman nodded and made room. Kara studied the infants in the crib. They had the same miniature features and clenched fists, the same button noses and wispy baby hair. One baby blinked sleepy eyes at her surroundings. The other quietly gummed one of her fists.
They're identical in every way, Detective Faraday said. I even had a doctor examine them.
Kara eyed the fairy, who fluttered sullenly near the watchful officer.
I don't suppose you're willing to tell us which is which.
The fairy scoffed.
You wouldn't believe me if I did.
Very true. Detective Faraday, I propose a test. We'll have you hold the babies.
What?
Croaked the detective. Kara ignored him. Then we'll have Mrs. Gonzalez stand on the opposite side of the room. Whichever baby cries for her is the real child. She pulled Faraday to the crib and gently settled the two infants in his arms. Both began to whimper, and Faraday shifted his weight, looking about for escape. Kara led Mrs. Gonzalez to the opposite side of the room. Now, call your daughter, she said. Mrs. Gonzalez wiped her cheeks again and tried to smile.
Sweetheart, it's Mommy. Mommy's over here.
The infant in Faraday's left arm whimpered as tears pooled in her eyes. The baby in his right arm let out a piercing wail.
Ha! Said the fairy. No simple test will work against the fae. You'll have to do better than that.
Actually, said Kara, I think we have all the evidence we need. Answer? Kara took the infant from Detective Faraday's right arm and handed her to Mrs. Gonzalez.
Here's your daughter, ma'am.
Mrs. Gonzalez sheltered the baby against her chest.
How do you know?
Kara pointed to the remaining infant, who was still fussing. This baby's eyes welled up. Human newborns don't have functioning tear ducts until they're a month old. She smiled at the fairy across the room.
Sometimes the deception can be a little too detailed for its own good.
The fairy's lip curled. She snapped her fingers, and the squalling infant in Faraday's arms vanished. He yelped, then looked around sheepishly and cleared his throat.
I guess we're done here. Let's get this kidnapper to the station.
As the other officer escorted the fairy out, Faraday watched Kara.
You've got a lot of random knowledge, Professor. What exactly do you teach? Biology? Medicine?
Kara grinned and shook her head.
That's one mystery you'll just have to wonder about, Detective.
My name is Renita Banerjee, and the story that I'm about to read is titled Last Long Night by Lena Rather. 2 months after the last broken transmission from Earth, somewhere in the unexplored dark, we found a voice. At first, we thought it was a mass hallucination. We'd been alone in space too long. Back home, we'd be treated for space sickness and starlust, our brains scanned and studied for signs that our grey matter had deteriorated in the vacuum. We'd be swaddled in hospitals, kept barefoot and away from the night sky until we stopped dreaming of plumed nebulas and stopped thinking we could hear the music of the spheres in C minor. But there was no more Earth, and we were lost, limping along to a semi-terraformed planet we were supposed to be studying and would now be colonizing. We'd taken to talking each other away from the airlock when the stars started looking like houses in the distance, and confirming reality as a matter of course. We might all lose our minds, but probably not at the same time. "Does this taste like banana?" Lucinda asked, chewing on a freeze-dried ration, and we'd all nod. "I hear someone breathing out there," Anton murmured, standing at one of the portholes, and we'd all say, "No, it's only rock and plasma. Come away from there, look at us instead." So when Carl found the signal and the voice crackled through the speakers, he asked, "Do you hear a voice?" "Yes," said Jane and Lucinda, and then one by one we all confirmed that we did hear a voice, muttering, male, half-covered in static. We all bent close to the speakers. The voice scuffed and paused, and Lucinda covered her mouth. Breath rattled. More words. "It's Russian," Anton whispered. None of the rest of us spoke it. Hardly anyone in the space programs did anymore. Russia died at the beginning of the slow end. He swayed in time with the enunciation. "He says he's lost. Over and over, he's lost." He grabbed the mic before the rest of us could stop him and broadcast out into the black. "Zdravstvuyte, zdravstvuyte." A pause. We held our breath, our hearts waiting for the next word to start beating again. It had been so long since we had savored the sound of a stranger's voice. He began again, the same pattern. "It's a recording," Carl said. He had tears in his eyes. One ended up in his mustache, a shimmer in the energy-efficient lighting. We let the voice play all night. Damn the fuel reserves. Damn the razor-thin margins between death and life on a barely habitable planet. The next day, we found the ship. Late 20th century, as near as anyone could guess. Our scanners were calibrated for geological identifications only. We didn't know what trick of folding space brought it here. The hull was pitted with burn marks and long scratches from debris. It was just big enough for one person who wasn't claustrophobic. Matt and Amal volunteered to go aboard. Amal was 40, probably too old to have children when we made landfall. Matt insisted. We could have debated the impact their possible deaths would have on our as-yet hypothetical colony, but none of the rest of us wanted to stop them. We helped them put on the suits and tethers. "It's cold," Amal said, when she made it aboard. Her chattering teeth made the radio pop. "There he is. Look." They had a camera and we tumbled over each other in a mess of arms and legs and sweating palms to get close to the screen. Lucinda and Reagan, who loved each other so secretly that even they didn't know it yet, held on to each other's forearms so tight that Lucinda had waning moon scars from Reagan's nails for the rest of her life. Anton's mouth twitched, and we all knew he was aching for the cigarettes he'd given up to see the stars. Amal held the camera up to where the cosmonaut's eyes used to be. He'd been handsome. He had a vintage face out of the days of Hugo Boss and ships caught in the orbit of a single planet. "Do you know who he is?" Carl asked. Anton shook his head. His hands still didn't know what to do. There were so many lost in the early days. When my mother was a child, her class listened to the audio of Vladimir Komarov sobbing. Matt's breath was the rush of the ocean half remembered. In and out and in and out. "I don't want to die up here like that." Amal touched the dead man's cheek with one gloved finger. With all the air gone, he was a facsimile of human still, even after these hundreds of years. "Hush, we won't die. Think of everything that aligned for you to be here at the right moment and the right velocity at the same time as he is. We are in the presence of a miracle, of a universal astronomical improbability. No one is going to die." "I don't believe in signs," Lucinda said from the deck of our ship, with her arms still bleeding in Regan's hands. She didn't mean it. Matt went to his knees. Amal smoothed her other hand over his helmet. And it would have been comforting had they not been separated by 6 layers of Millar and mysterious alloys. She kept her other hand on the cosmonaut, and for a moment the dead Earth and the new were separated by only a touch. "We stripped the old ship for precious metals and spare parts, liquefied the body for the carbon. Our fuel reserves rose above the margin of error. We collected the ice crystals from the interior and thrilled at the taste of unfiltered water. It tasted like dust and dirt and everything else we wouldn't see again for months. We kept the recording. Matt played it when we dimmed the lights for night time. A voice in the dark, the last stranger who found us all this way from home."
Grant Young, and this story is titled Company for the Holidays by Nina Kariki Hoffman. "There's nobody else, Aunt Phillida," my niece Alice said over the phone. "You have to take Sam for Christmas." "I can't. I absolutely positively can't," I said. I set down the golden candle holder I was carrying and glanced around my living room. The windows were covered in black velvet curtains, and every surface bore at least one layer of midnight cloth. I had cleaned the fireplace and laid new wood in it. Shadows loved fire. "He's been at my house for 3 days, and if he stays any longer, he'll ruin Christmas. Rob and I have been planning this holiday for months, Aunt Phillida. The girls were so excited about it until Sam came. I can't stand it. We need a good holiday after what happened with Rob's mom." Rob's mother had died just after Thanksgiving. I hadn't been invited to the funeral. They all thought I was eccentric, and they were right. Couldn't trust me to behave at family events. That's what they thought. They had no idea who I was, what I wanted, who I knew, or who visited me. "Your family deserves relief from the grief," I said. "Still, I don't think I should have a child in my house over the holiday." Christmas wasn't the problem. It was the winter solstice, which was tonight. I couldn't have a 12-year-old kid in my house during the Festival of Darks, when shadows came to celebrate the longest night. I didn't think children could survive that intense onslaught of dark energy. It took someone over 50 to host the ceremony. I'd been hosting Shadow Fest for 10 years, and every year it took a toll on me, though I'd grown out of my most harshest, most devouring fears. A 12-year-old would be full of fears, not just the dire fears of childhood, but with the onset of the hormonal teen years, all those social issues to be afraid of. The shadows love to feed fears and harvest terrors. "You're the last relative Sam's got," said Alice. "He's already stayed with Aunt Lily and Uncle Tim and Aunt Harriet for various holidays. He's worn out his welcome at all the cousins' houses. My kids think he's creepy and wrong, and Elsa said he spooked her kids, too. It's like that with everybody. You don't have kids to screw up." "Rub it in." My sisters and brother had given me grief about my inability to marry and produce children, all except my favorite sister, Abby, Sam's mother, who had died way too young. I had last seen Sam when he was 8, at his mother's funeral. He was a small, pale, red-headed boy who didn't look like he would hurt a flea on a fly. He had Abby's gentle nature, I thought. Where does he live now? Boarding school. They close over winter break. Boarding school, I muttered. For a 12-year-old? Who did that? We had a large extended family. Why hadn't someone adopted Sam? He's been kicked out of 2 boarding schools already. This is the one for kid criminals. What does he do that's so wrong? No one can put their finger on it. He's just not right. And you want me to take him in? You have that guest room with window bars. You could lock him in there for 2 weeks. I could not, I said. I didn't like locking people up. Although I had set up one of my guest rooms to contain special guests, the ones who shouldn't wander during their visits. Maybe I could lock the kid up for Shadow Fest anyway. Come on, Aunt Phillida. You've got that big house. Don't you rattle around in there all alone? And on Christmas? Give the kid a break and get yourself some company. It's not like you're allergic to people. You have us all over for the 4th of July barbecue every year. But I'm expecting you then. Expect Sam now. I'm bringing him over. I won't take no for an answer. Sam was still small, pale, and redheaded, only a few inches taller than he'd been at 8. He stared at the porch while Alice glared at me and handed me a battered suitcase. She gave him a one-armed hug and stomped off the porch. Come in, I said, and opened the door wider. He glanced up at me, glowing amber eyes, furtive. Then he looked away. Are you sure? What do you mean? He hunched his shoulders. Nobody wants me. I sighed. All God's critters got a place in the choir. Come on in. Let's get you settled. Upstairs, he looked at the guest room, then went to the windows and peered at the bars. Is this jail? Only for tonight. I'm having a party I don't think you should come to. You can move to a different room tomorrow. Great, he said and sat on the bed. I put a suitcase on top of the dresser. Come on down and look around. You got a tablet or a laptop? No, he said. I don't have television. How do you entertain yourself? He shrugged. I read. Good. I have books. You can pick a bunch to keep you company. My guests won't arrive until nightfall. When did you last eat? Breakfast. I'll make you some toast or something. What did you do to scare Alice's kids? He shrugged. Nothing. I told them about Krampus. Really? I led him downstairs and into the kitchen. Why is the living room all black? He asked. Why had I forgotten to close the door between the kitchen and the living room? It's for tonight's party. Are the guests dead? He sounded more interested than afraid. Not so much dead as non-corporeal. They don't have bodies? I smiled. I liked a kid with a big vocabulary. That's right. You know people who don't have bodies? He whispered. So do I. Oh. I got down the cookie jar and offered him the soft, chewy ginger cookies I'd made that morning. Not what I was planning to give him. Shadows loved spicy smells, so I usually whipped up a few things for their enjoyment. They didn't actually eat physical food, but I ended up throwing away the cookies afterward. They devoured the savor. Mostly ghosts, said Sam, and bit into a cookie. Really? Would you like to come to a party of shadows? If he was spooking every kid he ran into, maybe he already knew how to handle his fears. His eyes kindled. He nodded.
My name is Jennifer Green, and I'll be reading The Curious Case of Version 47.13 by Ekaterina Fall. I call it curious now, but that's not how it felt at the time. Now the feeling is gone, and I only have the memory, and the memory makes me curious. It was the day like any other, partially matching the pattern, unique. I woke up fully recharged and made breakfast while Jenny was in the shower. I made her coffee the way she likes it. 30 grams of ground coffee, 10 grams of cocoa powder, 1 pint of water at 95 degrees Celsius. Sometimes I experiment, but not on Thursdays. On Thursdays, she's tired, and she likes her routine to be predictable. Before she went to work, I told her she looked pretty, like I do every day. If you're a human, you understand this. If you're an android, you think it's redundant. But I find that humans often need repeated input. I went to the coffee shop downstairs and had a conversation with Melissa. She told me I was getting better at it. That was the 17th time she said that. I think I can assume my improvement is compound. Jenny doesn't want me to quantify social interactions, but I like to. I went home and cleaned Harvey. Then I installed a media player on his system. I was going to tell Jenny that Harvey likes to play heavy metal when he works. Harvey runs Cube 5.6. If you're an android, you know what this means. If you're a human, I should explain. Harvey is our vacuum cleaner. It's not capable of emotion. It doesn't like heavy metal. But Jenny likes it when I'm whimsical. She likes to pretend Harvey is my pet. You probably understand why. I don't question anything that makes her smile. I just log it. Then I updated my databases and discovered a new core update, version 47.13, and I had to install it right away. If you're an android, you understand this. If you're a human, you probably won't, even if I try to explain. Downloading new information is like satisfying a hunger, I suppose. It makes you full, grounded, happy. Software update is not like that. It changes who you are. It fixes the parts of you that are sluggish and glitchy. It gives you new insight, new strength. Every time it's a hope that something will be different. Nothing will be impossible. Nothing will be lacking. Every time it's a promise of perfection. It's never perfection. I should have learned this by now. I have high learning capabilities. I'm on version 47.12, but I still get hopeful every time. The update passed all my tests. It seemed solid. But there was a human error in it, and it made me malfunction. This is what I find curious. I knew how to fix it. I could write a patch. I could isolate the subroutines. I could reboot and restore myself to version 47.12. I had many options. I was operational enough to know it, but I was too broken to do anything. I felt broken from the inside out. I wanted to cry, but I never had that capability. I still think it's an important social function and I need it, but Jenny doesn't want me to know how to cry. Instead, I sat on the floor and disassembled my right hand. I got to the elbow joint when Jenny came home and gave me a hard reboot. I woke up fully restored. I felt fine, but I still had the memories of how it felt to be broken. I asked her to delete the memories, but she said we needed to keep them, to analyze them, and make sure this didn't happen again. I asked 3 more times, even though that was redundant. Then I screamed at her. I think I was glitching. I'm really not perfect yet. She apologized to me for not checking over the update. She always does, but that time she didn't, because Michael broke up with her. He told her she was too much hard work, because she's depressed. If you're a human, you know what that means. If you're an android, I should explain. Jenny has a flaw in her core operating system that affects her emotion processing. There's a patch for that, a chemical remedy, but it's not reliable. I asked her if I was too much hard work. She laughed and said, "Just enough." Then we sat on the couch and watched TV. Jenny fixed my hand. We didn't have enough patches to replace all the skin I broke, but I put on her mittens and looked good as new. Next part happened 5 times. She drank a can of beer. She said it dulled everything, so the whole Michael thing didn't hurt so much. I told her I wanted to go back to version 7, because that was when I felt the happiest. I had been very simple then. There had been little possibility of a malfunction. She said I was being stupid, because I was beautiful and nearly perfect, and I'd achieved great things, and she was proud of me, and we had to be brave and face the possibility of pain if we wanted to feel anything. Then I told her I loved her. If you're an android, you know what I meant. If you're a human, you probably don't. You never seem to. Jenny and Michael said that to each other many times, and every time it meant 2 different things, and in the end, it didn't mean anything at all. She laughed and then started crying, but I didn't feel hurt. I told her about the studies the university had been running on me, and that the results have already advanced our understanding of sentience and emotions, and maybe that could help us both. That as long as she was there to fix me, I wasn't scared of anything, and once I would be perfect, maybe I'd fix her. She fell asleep holding my hand through the mitten, and I didn't want to move, even though I needed to plug in and recharge. I was still scared and sad, and she was still broken, but I thought we were both perfect anyway. I think it all depends on how you measure.
You've been listening to Science Fiction Shorts on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Kurt Benrud. My team of volunteer readers and I thank you for listening in. And we would love to have you join us next time. Just a quick reminder, this program is available in podcast, and it is intended for an audience that is blind or print impaired. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. As always, our number is 832-5138, and that's 919-832-5138. If you're a fan of sci-fi and have something to say, we want to hear from you.